lift this up and go underground.
There is no policeman, so nobody to say it's not allowed.
Getting to know the nation through its artists, including political bearded women.
All the places of power are dominated by males. So we thought, why not barge in all these meetings wearing beards?
It looks a bit like Lenin's beard.
Kirsty Lang and Lucy Ash on the French Fringe this Monday to Friday at 1:45 on BBC Radio 4.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The writer Charles Williams is a former banker and Labour Party politician. He became a life peer in 1985 and was elected deputy leader of the opposition in 1989. Charles was a first-class cricketer and is now a first-class biographer of, for example, Macmillan, Pétain, de Gaulle and Don Bradman, a book, I am reliably informed, that's worshipped by cricket enthusiasts. Indeed, his latest work, Gentlemen and Players, about the death of amateurism in cricket, combines several of his passions and skills. Charles, you played about, I think, 87 first-class cricket matches.
Must be about that, yes. I haven't got a complete record, but I do know that I did make 4,000 runs in first-class cricket.
I noticed that you played with some quite wonderful people, and in fact, E.W. Swanton confused you with Colin Cowdrey. You were both playing. He wasn't sure which was which, although you very modestly give another reason for that.
Yes, this was really the brightest spot of my career, putting on 173 for the third wicket for Oxford against Lancashire with Colin. And said he modestly, I went on to make my 100, and Colin got out in the 90s, so I was rather pleased by that. But because we were both wearing a harlequin cap, Jim Swanton couldn't tell the difference between us. I think that was the point. But it was a great day.
Do you find that doing something like cricket at that level, or indeed at any level, actually, that the sort of team spirit and the thing of leading actually helped you quite a lot in other ways in life?
I think so. It's rather difficult to explain quite how or why. Cricket is a very curious game. It's partly individualistic, in the sense that if you go out to bat or if you run up to bowl, you're in the frame and nobody else. And partly a team game, because if you're fielding, that's part of a team. So it's a bit of both, and you have to learn how to adapt to your fellow players and also how to take responsibility for yourself. So I think that probably does help you in later life.
Because you also play chamber music.
Yes.
And there is a, you know, you have to listen to what other people are doing there.
That is indeed true. And I also played chamber music as an amateur. You see, we come back to amateurs again. And to a certain extent, I think I'm an amateur politician, if you want to say that.
So this must have been bubbling up in you, the idea of this book, for some time, I imagine, because it reflects a change in society, almost in philosophy, in the way that we look at things and see things.
I think that's right. I think it all started when I was doing my national service in the army, that I find it very odd that I should be bossed about by people who spoke with one voice and I should be bossing people about who spoke with a different voice. And the whole of the class structure of the army of the day, which is in the 1950s, was such as to create doubt in my mind as to whether this was the right way to run things. It seemed as though the amateurs were taking control of the professionals. And that's where I think it started, also where my politics started in the army, because at that point I came to the conclusion that it really wasn't quite fair, that there wasn't equality of opportunity, and I think that was what I decided to work on.
There's a slight, maybe considerable, ecclesiastical tinge to your life, which has continued because your stepson is Bishop of Durham. But I think that this slight ecclesiastical bent, if I might put it that way, influences your first choice of music.
Certainly does. I was born and brought up literally next door to a cathedral in Christ Church, Oxford. My father was Lady Margaret Professor of Divinity. And the first 10 years of my life was spent by the cathedral.
So this music, Monteverdi, where did you first encounter? And did you encounter it actually in the city where it was?
I have never heard it in St. Mark's, Venice. I think I've heard it in many cathedrals, not least Christchurch Cathedral, when I was very young. And the piece which we're going to hear is one of the motets which Monteverdi seemed to have fitted into the Vespers. It is about the seraphim and about the three in the end. So they tell me this is meant to describe the Trinity, the difficult and obscure doctrine of the Trinity. But also, and this is what I find so exciting about it, you can almost detect in the Venice of the day that there's a sort of Moorish Arab element in it. After all, Venice was a great trading city at the time. And you could almost hear the muezzin as the singers go on, and that's what makes it so exciting. It's a mixture of cultures.
Oh!
Lovely piece of music. I got to know Bob Teare quite well. I was glad to hear him sing that, and I've never heard him sing that before. He was a lovely man, and I was terribly sorry when he died, and it was nice to hear him sing. Also, John Elliott Gardner. I used to play chamber music with John Elliott Gardner when he was studying in Paris under Nadia Boulanger. He used to play the viola, and we used to play Amateur. Of course, I reminded him of that the other day when I saw him, and he'd completely forgotten him, and all other grand things had happened to him. But then it suddenly clicked, and he did remember.
Well, the only person you didn't know here really was Monteverdi himself. But you know him quite well through his music, Charles Williams. That was Duo Seraphim from the Vespers of 1610 by Monteverdi. We heard Robert Teare and Philip Langridge, the tenors, and John Shelley Quirk, the baritone, with the Monteverdi Choir and Orchestra, conducted by John Elliott Gardner. We haven't really made it clear that the clarinet is your instrument.
Yes. That I took up at Westminster where I was at school, partly because as a child I was bullied into learning the piano, and I got stuck endlessly on that dear old Brahms waltz. Da, 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 da. I just couldn't get past the fifth bar. And when I went to Westminster, I said, I'm going to give up the piano. I can't stand it. And then I found I missed music, and I missed actually performing music. And so I said to myself, well, I'll take up an instrument. And I consulted people. And in the end, I took up the clarinet because I wanted to play jazz. But gradually, I reverted to the classical clarinet, which I've been playing ever since, with absolute enormous enjoyment, I've got to say. It does seem to me that it does enhance your knowledge of music if you can actually perform the music yourself. And I feel rather sad that people who just simply listen to gramophone records and don't actually take up an instrument themselves.
The music we're going to play is a kind of triumph over adversity, because when he wrote it, the composer was actually in a prisoner of war camp.
He was. He was in a prisoner of war camp in Silesia. And he just had a group of people and found some instruments. The cello only had three strings. The clarinet had to be patched together. Half the notes on the piano didn't really work. And they gave a performance in freezing cold in January 1941. And this whole piece is about time, of course. It's the end of time. And Messiaen himself said the piece that we're going to hear is the lassitude of time. It's a beautiful expression. My father tried to persuade Einstein, who was at Christchurch at the time before the Second World War, to become a Christian. He wasn't very successful at that, but Einstein did say to him that we need time, because otherwise everything would happen at once and we couldn't cope. And the Messiaen piece, I think, gives that enormous traction. The long notes on the clarinet are part of the lassitude, the slight depression. Then the bird comes in and cheers everything up, and then you go back.
Thank you.
And imagine trying to play that with cold fingers. It was bitterly cold in January 1941 on a dodgy clarinet.
How do you find playing the birdsong bits?
With warm fingers.
Abîme des oiseaux for clarinet from the quartet for the End of Time by Messiaen, played there by Gervaise de Paille. You spent a certain amount of time travelling in your life, but both professionally in your jobs, but also, I rather gather, for fun.
Oh, yes. I mean, one should always travel for fun, even if it's professionally.
I'm guided to this thought by the choice of the next music, which is Volare.
This is Rome 1960. I was sent out by BP to help with their preparations for the Olympic Games of 1960 in Rome. I was told I'd be there for 3 months, and I managed to make it into 10 months. They gave me a car so I could drive all the way around Italy, saw everything in Italy, did all my sightseeing in the spring before the summer. The girls were beautiful. The Roman friends that I had were immensely entertaining. The weather was fine. And for a bachelor, age 27, you really couldn't ask for anything more pleasant than that.
And this piece?
This piece was part of the whole scene of La Dolce Vita. It was the classic pop music of the time.
Volare, oh, cantare, oh, nel blu dipinto di blu, felice di stare lassù. E volavo, volavo felice, più in alto del sole ed ancora più su. Mentre il mondo pian piano spariva lontano laggiù. Una musica dolce suonava soltanto per me. Volare, oh, cantare, oh, 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 nel blu dipinto di blu, felice di stare lassù, ma tutti i sogni nell'alba svaniscono perché quando tramonta la luna li porta con sé. Ma io continuo a sognare negli occhi tuoi belli, che sono blu come un cielo trapunto di stelle. Volare, oh, cantare, oh, 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 nel blu degli occhi tuoi blu, felice di stare qua giù. E continuo a volare felice, più in alto del sole ed ancora più su. Mentre il mondo pian piano scompare negli occhi tuoi blu. La tua voce è una musica dolce che suona per me. Volare, oh, cantare, oh, 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 nel blu degli occhi tuoi blu, felice di stare qua giù.
It does immediately conjure up an atmosphere, a sensibility, a place and a time, doesn't it?
Immediately. Italy, Rome, 1960.
Volare, from Domenico Modugno. Charles, we were talking earlier about Gentlemen and Players, your new book about amateurism, and we're coming on to a Mozart serenade, which I imagine you know pretty well backwards. And I wonder if we could expand a little bit more on the links between amateur and professional, because presumably in music we transcend that to a certain extent, because people carry on mixing together and playing music.
To a certain extent, that's true. But the professional musician, this is what we're finding out in Wales at the moment, the professional musician has to put in the hours of practice. The amateur musician doesn't necessarily, or often can't possibly afford the time to do so. So it's quite a difficult mix. Now, in the Mozart that we're going to hear in the serenade, we had a group of amateur musicians in London, and we played all sorts of pieces of chamber music, even the 13-wind instrument Mozart, but all amateurs. Some students, if you're trying to cross the divide between amateur and professional. And we used to play in gardens, we used to play in schools. I remember once we played this particular Mozart in the garden of Thurlow Square. And after the first movement, we heard a blackbird singing away. And we thought, well, this is very odd, not a loud blackbird. And it turned out that it was one of the neighbours who was able to sing like a blackbird. And she was accompanying us. So it was all very jolly and great fun. But we did put in, I say it shouldn't be, we put in some quite good performances. And this, of course, is most marvellous work.
Just before we hear it, you mentioned Wales and music making, and I think you've been rather passionately involved in trying to promote a new chamber orchestra and chamber music, indeed, in the sort of mid-Wales area.
Yes, very much so. This started about 5 years ago, and the mid-Wales Chamber Orchestra is going extremely well. We've got some good chamber music, and we're building up an audience. And Brecon is, you know, coming on fine. This is the jazz festival when we're there. And it's an exciting place to be. I think we are putting in some good work for people in Mid Wales, not least the schools, because we have a very big educational programme in schools.
And allowing them to hear music like this played by professionals. Mm.
All professionals.
Thank you.
Sheer genius. Mm. It's so simple, but although it's technically fairly easy to play, musically, I find Mozart one of the most difficult composers to play. You listen to yourself, you record yourself, you say, no, that's not right, that's not the way he meant it. And it is extremely difficult to get it right.
How did you feel about the tempo there, as someone who's played this a lot?
I thought that they started off rather slowly, to be honest. They picked up as they went on, but we always used to start off with a bit of a really quite robust allegro. But they, I think, had a little bit of variation in rallentandos, which I didn't much
care
for.
Well, we can take that up with Michael Collins, clarinetist, who was leading London Winds in the first movement of the Serenade in C minor, Kirkel 388 by Mozart. The next music, Charles Williams, I think you had at the blessing of your wedding, and you had a rather illustrious conductor to supervise it.
I did. We had a blessing at Great Bardfield in Essex, and I was the director of the Schütz Choir at the time, which had been founded by Roger Norrington. And I asked Roger if he would bring along some members of the Schütz Choir to sing for us. And he did, and very kindly. The only problem was that he wore some rather flamboyant red socks. And the congregation couldn't really concentrate on music. All they could think about was Roger's red socks. And in the end, the priest had to interrupt, more or less, and said, no, let's get on with the business. But the Brahms that we chose, in which they sang, there's such beautiful pieces that we thought that was quite right for our blessing, even with Roger's red socks.
I think it's a particularly happy choice for us, because we haven't heard this very often on Private Passions. Just tell us what they're singing about here.
They're a Marienlieder, the Songs of Mary. Brahms wrote them when he was really quite young, but he wrote them for unaccompanied voices. And they are really designed to celebrate the Virgin Mary.
And this is Ruf zu Maria.
Oh,
Ruf zu Maria from Marienlieder, Opus 22 by Brahms, the Danish National Radio Choir, conducted by Stefan Parkman. Charles Williams, when you found yourself in the Lords, presumably, of course it is a political appointment in your case, but presumably the fact that it's there to scrutinise what is coming from the Commons makes it a much less cut-and-thrust kind of chamber. On the other hand, it has an expertise which makes, when there is cut-and-thrust, somewhat more telling quite often.
Yes, I think that's right. A lot of people think that we make legislation. We do not make legislation. The Commons make legislation. All the Lords can and should do is to ask the Commons, if necessary, to think again about particular pieces of legislation. And it's then the Commons will have to decide. And at the end of whatever day it is, the Lords always bends to the will of the Commons, and that's right. That said, the weight of opinion from the Lords can be quite convincing because of the people who have been there, as it were, and done that, have had a career and have come to the Lords after a career, either in politics or in business or in banking or whatever it may be. And that makes the opinion more persuasive than if they're just political appointees. The other thing, you're right in saying it's less partisan than the Commons, and I think a gentler chamber than the Commons, which is not to criticise the Commons, just the way it is.
If some of the proposed changes went through, is there a danger of A, losing expertise, and B, that you end up in a position where the upper house might sort of stymie the work of the lower house? Because, after all, if it's elected, then why shouldn't it have a complete say-so?
Well, that's right. I think that's the main argument against the proposals which may be coming forward from the government.
And yet, as a man who is absolutely steeped in democracy, and you explained how, when you were doing national service, you didn't like the kind of privilege, as it were, this must be rather difficult for you.
Yes, I'm not against a wholly elected upper house. Not a partially a hybrid upper house, but a wholly elected upper house. But you would have to define very carefully, to come back to your point, the relationship between the two houses. And that could only be defined at the moment at which the composition of the House of Lords changes. So there is a lot of work to be done if we're going to have an elected house.
Would it be a bit like America, do you think, the Senate and the House of Representatives?
I don't think it could ever be like, they've got their own system, the Senate and the House. I don't think we'd ever be like that. But we have to get over this hurdle, which in a way the Americans haven't got over, where both houses are directly elected and both claim, therefore, legitimacy. And they can just have rows with one another. And there are times, to be honest, when the governance of the United States comes to a complete halt because the two houses just can't agree with one another. And I hope that won't happen here.
We heard a wonderfully pared-down piece in many ways in the Messiaen, although the bird took off in quite sort of frantic form. And we're going to go back again to something which I think is quite pared down and is again 20th century. And it's lovely to have Messiaen Berg in the programme.
Yes, I'm very fond of this piece. It is, as you say, very pared down and just explodes in the middle. And is very rewarding to play. But it's an attractive piece. It says an enormous amount, in my view, in a very short space of time. Thank you. Again, you have the clarinet going down to nothing. Mm. Pianissimo, I think, is marked with four P's, and it goes down to nothing.
And sort of fluttering out to nothing, or like a heartbeat almost. Yes. That was number one of Opus 5 by Berg, the four pieces for clarinet and piano, of which we heard the first. Sabine Meyer playing the clarinet, with Oleg Meisenberg playing the piano. We started Charles Williams with something which had a wonderfully ecclesiastical atmosphere to it. And here we have something to finish which has a triumphant ecclesiastical connotation.
Very much so. It's all about the Day of Judgment. It's stupendous music, this. And I first heard it, I went with my sister to Salzburg in, I think it was 1968, and we heard Karajan and the Berlin Orchestra do this piece, the Grand Messe des Morts. And we were sort of pinned to the back of our seats. You had four brass bands, three lots of cymbals, I think there are 12 kettle drums, an enormous orchestra, 140-piece orchestra. And this Lacrimosa is all about the Day of Judgment and the possibility of redemption. And it starts with the soul sort of wailing away and saying, it's all absolutely dreadful, what are we going to do? And then it ends suddenly in the major key and said, absolutely, as you say, triumphantly, it's all going to be all right on the night. And that's a marvellous piece of music it is.
Bye.
it was first performed in the Invalides in, I think it was 1835, the priest at the altar on that moment burst into tears.
You were not so much in tears, but you were playing the timpani and singing along, Charles Williams. That was the Lacrimosa from the Grande Messe des Morts by Berlioz. The Boston Symphony Orchestra, the New England Conservatory Chorus, and the conductor was Charles Munch. Well, Charles Williams, thank you for taking us down some quite interesting byways as well as highways during this last hour. And I think it only remains for me now to wish you a truly prosperous innings with gentlemen and players.
Thank you very much.
Charles Williams was talking to Michael Barclay. And next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the Australian novelist Thomas Keneally. Private Passions is a classic arts production for Radio 3, and the producer of today's programme was Chris Marshall.
On what would have been Benjamin Britten's 99th birthday, Radio 3 Live in Concert brings you a performance of works by Purcell, Tippett, Handel and Britten himself. Alice Coote and the Britten Sinfonia combine in a celebration of English musical connections to Benjamin Britten. Join me, Katie Derham, on Thursday night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
And we have an all-English Sunday concert for you in an hour's time here on BBC Radio 3. It's a concert celebrating the 50th anniversary of Croydon's Fairfield Halls. Vaughan Williams' Wasps Overture, Finzi's Clarinet Concerto, played by Michael Collins, and Elgar's The Music Makers. Catherine Wynne Rogers is the mezzo-soprano soloist in that, and John Wilson conducts the BBC Symphony Chorus and Orchestra. That's our Sunday concert in an hour from now at 2 o'clock. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's now 1 o'clock, time for the latest BBC News, read by Lopa Kotari.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said Israel is prepared to significantly expand its military operations in Gaza. Israel's air and sea forces have been bombarding the territory overnight in response to rocket attacks from Palestinian militants. Two missiles are believed to have been intercepted heading towards Tel Aviv. The Foreign Secretary, William Hague, said Israel risked losing international support if it began a ground invasion. But he said Hamas bore principal responsibility for sparking the current violence. The Arab League says its delegation will visit Gaza on Tuesday. The Business Secretary, Vince Cable, has said Britain needs to adopt a tougher approach on tax avoidance by large firms. Speaking to the BBC's Andrew Marr, he said while the UK needed to remain attractive to big companies, more needed to be done to crack down on tax dodging. His comments came as the multinationals Amazon, Google and Facebook were questioned about their arrangements by MPs last week. The British car maker Jaguar Land Rover is to open a new factory in China, which will begin production in 2015. The company says it struck a £1 billion deal with the Chinese firm Chery to create the new plant near Shanghai. Jaguar Land Rover's sales in China are up 80% so far this year. Leading medical organisations have called on the government to set a minimum price per unit of alcohol at 50 pence. In a joint letter to the Sunday Times, the Alcohol Health Alliance UK, which includes the British Medical Association and the Royal College of Nursing, say the move would target heavy drinkers who cause the most damage to themselves and those around them. An entire South London neighbourhood policing team has been axed after some officers were found to have been playing poker and backgammon while on duty. Seven officers from the team in Bromley resigned or were sacked after an undercover investigation revealed their actions. And the weather, fine and sunny for most parts. Rain in the far northwest of Scotland will spread into Northern Ireland and North Wales during the course of the day. Cloud moving into southwestern parts by the evening. That's the latest BBC News and weather. The time is coming up to 1:03.
Thank you, Lopa Kotari. Well, a very good afternoon from me, John Shea, with you this Sunday afternoon here on BBC Radio 3, which continues now with today's early music show presented by Lucy Skeeping.
My Sweet Little Darling Sing Lulla Lullaby, a gentle cradle song from Elizabethan England, possibly by William Byrd. And how perfect to have it accompanied by the smooth, homogeneous tones of a consort of viols. The singer there was Alain Zepfel with Les Éléments. It's not often on the Early Music Show that we aim to put you to sleep, but if you feel a sense of drowsiness coming on, don't worry. Today we're looking at lullabies of all sorts, and they do come in many shapes and forms, as we're going to hear, from conventional rocking melodies or religious chant to timeless folk song and more. So for the next hour, forget about the cares of the world, grab your teddy and drift off. I saw a sweet, seemly sight, a two-voice lullaby from the 15th century performed by the singers of Anonymous Four. Lullabies are common to all cultures, of course. Anyone who's had a sleepless infant will know just how effective music can be. Whether you're in a stately home, a suburban semi or a mud hut, the same rules apply. A rocking rhythm, a mother's voice and lots of soothing repetition. And these characteristics can even be found in this lullaby from Turkmenistan. Passed down from mother to child, its origins can be traced back some 5,000 years. It describes a mother's hopes and dreams for her baby.
Miss Wasley, Arain, Gary, she, the lunter,
A traditional lullaby from Turkmenistan, from a BBC archive recording. I suppose generally we tend to associate lullabies with the 19th century, don't we? Romantic songs by people like Brahms, Schubert or Schumann. But long before that, composers were using traditional lullaby tunes for inspiration to create sometimes quite complex art music, particularly in 16th century England. The composer Anthony Holborn set lullabies in popular dance forms, pavans, galliards and so on. He was a courtier in the service of Queen Elizabeth. He was a lawyer and a great lover of literature as well as a musician.